Disclaimer. The information shared on this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be considered as professional advice or a substitute for seeking professional advice. I'm Jake Deptula, and this is Love Less Fridays. Here we delve deeper into the topics, themes, and stories featured on Love Less Fear. Joining Michelle Locke and I is Alan Amaranjan, who shared her story in episode 16 of Love Less Fear, It's a Lot Worse Than We Thought. While searching for her dream partner, Alan meets a seemingly kind and attentive Montana man who quickly confesses his love for her, asks her to be his girlfriend, and even proposes. However, as a relationship deepens, Alan starts to feel something isn't quite right. Her frustrations grow and she begins to sense a pattern of gaslighting. Digging deeper, she uncovers the presence of his ex-girlfriend and things start to unravel. Alan realizes that long-distance relationships often come with their own brand of deception.
I know what a type of person I was looking for, the characteristics. I've always been pretty clear on that. And I thought, oh, maybe that, you know, this guy's coming across my path for a reason or something. And I swiped yes. He was all the things that I hadn't experienced in conversations prior with people. And that was something that really drew me in and that I appreciated about him. Within less than a week, he told me that he loved me. That was right after our first FaceTime, within probably 20 minutes of us getting off the phone. At that same time, he told me that he wanted to have kids with me, couldn't wait for me to be their mom. Within 2 hours, probably 2 hours of being there, I was with his mom. They said, Alan and him are going to be coming by. They're with us now. We'll all be together later or something. And the person said, who's Alan? Who's that? I can't keep track of them. So it went from I'm single to she has stuff here. She needs to come get the rest of her stuff to I'm moving it into a storage unit to I hear her in the background one night and she's coming to get her stuff. She just showed up to she actually found out about you and now she's refusing to leave.
Alan has also created her own podcast about exploring relationship trauma, delving deep into love, betrayal, shattered illusions, and healing, entitled When Heaven Meets Hell. Alan, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here with you guys.
Alan, this was the perfect scenario of out of sight, out of mind, in my opinion.
Yes.
You see people like this man in your life who easily took advantage of a variety of things. One is the fact that you were long distance, so a lot of his behavior, a lot of his activity was not transparent to you. You were pretty certain and you were pretty assured of what you were looking for. Do you think at first there was an archetype of who this man was and then ultimately thought in your mind, were you building and forecasting the potential of who he was versus who he really turned out to be pretty quickly in your life?
It's a good question. I feel like I read things as they come and kind of tend to trust my gut and be myself and show up as that. And obviously I read things wrong on this one, but I trusted what I was being told at the time. And that's all I can kind of go with on that one, I think, is that I just trusted what was being given to me. And you can only ask so many things out at once. And how do you know someone's lying with when you don't know them that well? I think that's kind of where I was at with that.
I was going to ask, how much of your history in what you've gone through in your health journey and the prior trauma you had made the long distance dating safer for you? Like, did you find it to be a safer experience than if you had been in person? Because I think, you know, a lot of times when you have trauma, you look for what fills your soul, but also protects you at the same time. And there is some element to that with distance relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something I've definitely, my therapist brought that up too. It's a good one. It's a good question. She talked about that. And I think that that's definitely something that it wasn't a negative for me. And I'm a very independent person to some degree. I enjoyed being able to have fun, do our thing, enjoy our time together, and then go home and live my life and relax. And enjoy.
You can come and go as you please.
Yeah. And, you know, there's pros and cons with that. And as if you think of that on his end, then that's a different story. If we're coming and going as we please, but using that in a different way. Health-wise, I think it was my reprieve was when we weren't together because I was on a roller coaster, and whether I realized it or not, when we weren't physically together is when I was down and usually pretty rough shape health-wise and kind of in bed recovering, trying to feel better for the next time and get my strength back. So it ended up working out, and it was fine for me. And also my health team is here, obviously. And so it wasn't like I was making a move and uprooting my life there completely at that time. So I think it lended itself to me in my life.
Well, because as your mom said, you never packed.
I know. She's an observant one. Yeah, definitely.
It's just interesting because people like he was mm-hmm. and the archetype that Jake talked about, they pick on particular archetypes of people. Mm-hmm. And you fit that. You were strong. You were independent. You wanted to come and go as you please. And so you fit the mold for the target, whether you knew it or not. But it also fulfilled your needs because it was at a safe distance that protected you long term. And you could get invested, but you didn't have to get that invested. Because the reality is, if you were 100% invested, you would have packed, and you never did. What I loved about your story in particular was that something in your gut kept you back. And so that to me is what resonated about your story, was that your gut was like, nah, I'm not fully buying in yet. From what I heard from your stories, everything was compartmentalized. He compartmentalized his family. He compartmentalized you. He compartmentalized his girlfriend who was living with him at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that is one of the huge red flags right there, is if your life isn't integrated and everyone's compartmentalized, what are you hiding?
Right. A lot.
I wanted to give you like a hug and say, I'm so sorry you went through this because you were truly bamboozled.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate it.
It was really interesting for me because I've actually talked about this a lot recently in some of my own online stuff as it relates to listening to what the exes say and the red flags of what people will say. Oh, well, the ex is crazy. Oh, the ex is crazy. Oh, the ex is crazy. And the reality is, y'all, the ex isn't crazy. The reality is the ex knows the person. And that's the distinction. And that to me, and I was on a morning show in San Antonio 2 weeks ago where I talked about just this, is that if the ex is saying they're crazy, they're crazy, they're crazy, that's not them. It's the person you're talking to. Who is the common denominator in what you're talking about? And if the common denominator is the person that you're dating, then that's the problem. If every one of their exes is crazy, then they're the problem, right? It's not just the one person that's crazy. If they have ex after ex after ex is crazy, then hello. It's not just a red flag. It's like the flashing warning hazards. Do not enter. Do not cross. Do not come online. You're going to blow up. But yeah, I mean, that was what struck me as that one, is that his family knew. That being said, I think he also played them, but they should have listened to the warning signs, which is, well, everyone's crazy. The ex is crazy. And I don't think she was crazy.
From the very, very start of, you know, my ex is crazy and all that stuff. When you're talking about that, I was trying to think about what the narrative was of past girlfriends, even beyond his most recent ex. And it was really just kind of focused on his most recent one, mainly because she was most prevalent or became.
Well, yeah, because he was living with her.
Yeah. Yes. She became very involved. But I guess, you know, I heard a tiny bit about past ones, but those we didn't really have conversations about. And so I think, too, that's an interesting thing, is that the narrative wasn't they're all crazy. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I'm best friends with them and we hang out, or they're great people by any means. It wasn't positive, but it wasn't something we talked about a ton to where it was kind of a pattern or anything that I picked up on. It was really just focused on the one, which is interesting.
That is interesting. Cause that also, yeah. And that happens as well. It's just the one that's crazy, but that one is like extra crazy.
Just right. Yeah. Oh, 100%. Right. Everyone thinks so. And it's terrible. Yeah. And like, it was stay away for your protection. All that, you know, was very, very intense.
It's triangulate, triangulate, triangulate.
Yeah. Yeah, but in your gut, and I know, and my sister-in-law is so big on it, and we had conversations, and she's like, well, you know, what about, you know, how would you feel if that was said about you, or think about the other woman? And we had these conversations a ton, you know, what would it mean if a man says that? And we had them. I think that's a big part, too, of the gut instinct, and it's you know, there's two sides to everything, and what made him say that. And I feel like it was always just an information gathering session, and I never fully got a ton. I got as much as I maybe could. And I think the family was another component to it. But yeah, I think that's why my gut, it was never fully settled.
Did you have any of his exes after you released the show reach out to you and want to share their story with you?
I have had a few who have reached out. I've actually had quite a few women who have reached out saying I have something very similar in a similar area. You know, I'm an open book, obviously. I've shared a ton. It's also not something that I'm seeking vengeance with and trying to form a crusade of things. I have kept that very, very general and just said, I'm so sorry to hear that. Thank you for listening kind of thing. No one has specifically asked me names. I'm not giving out names. I'm still very protective of things, and that's just a me thing. So I've been contacted and reached out to, but unless I knew you and heard of you prior, I'm still feel very cautious and protective of things, just because I think it's a very sticky situation and I don't care to step on anything else with it.
You're not there to blast him.
No, I'm not. It's not the goal.
You're there so others don't make your same mistakes.
Yeah. And so I don't ever want to turn someone away or downplay anything. So my goal with that is just to respond as graciously and empathetically as possible. But I really don't want to turn back on that phase of my life where it's hearing about bonding over a story that could be similar.
It's onwards and upwards for you. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Your episode of Love, Less, Fear was recorded before you released your podcast.
Yes.
And so your podcast is basically a deep dive and exploration into your own experiences and also inviting other people to be able to help provide case analysis, situations, and share their own level of relationship trauma. What was the number one thing that inspired you to say, I'm going to embrace the podcast format and I'm going to do a multi-part series based on my experiences?
Just wanting to talk about it in a expanded format for women, because there's so much to get into with these things. I felt heavy carrying it. Felt like it was something that I didn't want to carry. I didn't ask to carry, but it was my reality for so long. And it was something that I felt like I authentically couldn't just move on from, or all these things that you hear people talk about. And I needed to get it out there in some way, not only for myself in a kind of cathartic healing manner, but also I felt like there were all these things that we don't talk about, and I wanted to talk about them. And it's more than just a single Instagram post or, you know, a story or something that I was kind of used to. And so enter in a podcast format, and it just kind of became what it was, and splitting things up and trying to explain things as best I could and explain concepts and kind of lay things out for people with what it can look like and start to look like and turn into. And that was kind of the mission behind it.
What has changed for you internally? What's the impact been from that? And also, what's changed for you externally about other people in your life, possibly including him, who may have been impacted by you sharing your story?
Internally, you mentally prepare, I suppose. I talk to quite a few people in the space, and, you know, you understand what you're doing in putting out something, so vulnerable and doing it very publicly.
I mean, you were putting yourself out there and saying, hey, I'm a target, come pick on me.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand that. It was kind of interesting because I'm so organized, and I had this whole idea of I'm going to have this whole show done when I go to release. And so that was kind of my mindset. It didn't happen that way. It happened to where I was recording essentially weekly. If anything, I was about a week ahead. And that made it pretty interesting because I was kind of having live feedback on it, both good and bad. The feedback was essentially all really great and warm and supportive, but, you know, you also get feedback from naturally friends, family who are listening and saying, it's really hard to listen to this, or I don't know how you could have been in something like this, or I wish you would have talked to me more.
Yeah, how could you? How could you not let us know?
Well, yeah,
can I give you the reasons why I didn't let you know?
Exactly. So I felt like I was kind of on damage control a little bit. You know, I would do my kind of calls and texts before an episode went out saying, I would prefer if you didn't listen to this one, or don't feel like you need to listen to this one. And then after that, it was just kind of going from there. I feel like support was great with it. There became a few reviews and things I've talked to you about this that felt left field, and that's part of it. And I understand that it doesn't feel good. If anything, I think that some of those make sense. I can see where they're coming from.
Haters are going to hate no matter what you do. I mean, 100%. There's always, not everyone's going to like you, and not everyone's going to like your store, and they're all going to have, every asshole has an opinion. I mean, it just, 100%. That's the reality of it.
Yeah. I think some of them, you know, some I can very clearly tell who they are from. And so that's fine. And I get that. And that's great. Some I had a hard time with because I can take it. And that's, again, like you just said, say whatever you want to me. I felt like, if anything, it's discouraging other people from sharing their story, to the point of all the questions survivors get. Why did you stay? This just sounds like a bad relationship. You should have seen it coming. All these things, and they're so valid, things that I've run through in my mind.
I'm going to disagree. They're not valid. Because until you are in it, and until you are living it, to say, why didn't you get out? Please understand, I'm on the same boat where you are. We lived it, or you live it, and it's not some easy thing where you can flip the switch. And I think the people that say those things, well, why didn't you get out? Why didn't you leave? Aren't living that dynamic, because you can't just flip a switch and get out. Mm-hmm. You just can't. I don't care what anyone says.
We've all built community in our own way. So we take on the burden of the pain that the survivors may feel from comments based on what they've gone through. For hundreds of stalking survivors who have received thousands upon thousands of the most disgusting, racist, misogynistic, homophobic, hateful comments that none of the things that pass the muster on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or things we don't catch when it goes to Instagram, will make any remote real impact. It's hurtful. Don't get me wrong. It is hurtful and it is wrong. But the best thing you can do in these situations is, if they see it, you have a direct conversation. Then they know you've got their back. And we've been fortunate to be in the strong position to stand by it. No, we stand by our survivors that come forward. We stand by their stories. We stand by who they are. The people that don't walk in their shoes, as Michelle said, and they want to come forward and make these sort of left field comments, don't really have the right to do so, but they do have the right to get on the platform and share. We may not agree with what they say, but oftentimes, to be fair, it's misinformed. Out of all the comments, how many are really constructive? How many are really helpful? How many really address the healing? You can say, I didn't like the way this person shared this story, but I do understand what they shared. That's fine. You know what I'm saying? That's a personal sort of take on this. And that's based on my experience in 5 years doing this.
And Jake's 100% right. And until you get that phone call like you did, Alan, with the girlfriend saying, oh, I've been engaged to him for 5 years. Like, you don't understand the horror of that, or the horror of someone calling you. I can give you the story. It's just from what I do for a living. But it's the wife calls and says, did you have his baby? Is that baby yours? That stuff happens. Everyone thinks, oh, no, that's just in the books. Y'all, it's not. After doing 22 years of family law, I can tell you, it's not just in the books. It is the reality of life. Because guess what? Life is messy. And to go back to what Jake said, survivors are survivors. And they survive everything. And they don't get to the bit where you are, Alan, telling your story and sharing it and being as vulnerable as you are without basically giving everyone the middle finger. Say, this is my story. This is my truth. Take it or leave it. Shove it. Don't care.
Right.
Yeah, sorry, Jake. No. I had to use a middle finger at some point today.
It makes me happy. It makes me happy.
Well, no, we need the audio captions on this one because, Alan, we've talked about this before. Michelle is a very visual person, so, and she likes to use cues in order to signal certain things, like Jake's talking, middle finger goes up. Alan's talking, smile and nod. It's really about that, and I wish we were recording video just for this purpose, but unfortunately we're not. So anyone listening – we don't have video representation, but we'll do a frame grab afterwards and just to see what kind of cast of characters you're dealing with in your hearing.
There's a reason. There's a reason why we don't do video right now.
Oh, there's a lot of reasons why we don't do video right now. Is there anything that you feel comfortable sharing here that you didn't share during Loveless Fear or When Heaven Meets Hell?
Episode 2, I talked a bit about some sexual abuse that happened, and not that it was glossed over or anything. I had really kind responses to it, but I think that there was a lot more with that that I'm still kind of working on and overcoming. And it was so early on in the show that people just kind of kept moving with it. And some of the responses were just along the lines of it wasn't enough abuse for people. And I think that is interesting to me, and that makes me feel like I didn't convey it well enough. And that's something that I have like kind of been lit on fire for with other survivors, is like, okay, well, I did it to the best of my abilities and talked about it as much as I felt like I could for a lot of reasons, not only personally, but legally. I didn't want to get into anything, but also it's never something that you should need to prove or
God, no. Like, for anyone to say, well, you didn't prove your sexual abuse, or you didn't prove that you had this abuse.
Yeah. Or that it's, you know, that you were hurt enough or impacted enough, or
who gets to say that unless they experience themselves up yours?
That's really disgusting.
I mean, it's disgusting unless you've experienced it, because everyone's trauma is different. Everyone's response to trauma is different. And to say there should be some uniform, like, here's your response wasn't this, what didn't happen, is absolutely absurd.
Right, right. Yeah.
What do you both think gives someone the right to make a comment like that? I mean, that is particularly heinous, if you think about it, in terms of basically re-victimizing someone in this way. It really does put a survivor in a position to not want to come forward, to be criticized for talking about the trauma that they experienced. So that particular comment or anything like that, I can imagine could be extremely damaging. But you're here with us today, and you're moving forward, and you're bringing other survivors forward.
Yeah, I'm proud of it. And I feel like it's my truth. I'm not ever going to change it or embellish it or do anything different. And I feel like the whole point of me telling my story is that it looks different than a lot of forms of what we hear about and talk about. And I think that that's kind of what I wanted to touch on and where I was coming from. And if that's not quote unquote enough for someone, or enough for someone who's experienced more, then that's their prerogative and that's their experience to go through and work through. I feel like, again, and I will say this and have said this, is I'm my own worst critic, and I have thought through any comment probably that you can throw at me. I've thought of it myself prior, especially in thinking through sharing your own story. I've thought about it, and I even thought about that one of, and I've sat with my therapist of being like, is this enough? I would never want to, you know, stand next to women who have been in abusive situations for longer, or who have gone through something maybe more severe physically, and claim that mine is the same. And we've had those conversations at length. That's something that I've had to work through and rectify. And it's not a competition. Abuse is not a competition.
It's not a competition for who had it worse. Everyone's experience is unique. Everyone gets to live their own, whatever their trauma was. And good for your therapist, by the way, for helping you through that. That's an amazing therapist.
She's wonderful.
Alan, can you mention what advice your therapist gave you once you brought sort of the heinous, traumatic, and potentially triggering comments about you sharing your story to her, and what kind of tips or tools or advice that she gave you?
Yeah, gosh. We talked about a lot prior, you know, and I said, I want to do this. Do you think I should do this? You know, and are you in support of this? And we've had those conversations a lot. And her point of view, and she's done a lot of advocacy work and stuff like that, is that your story is your story and no one gets to tell you anything different. And if you're standing in your truth, then that's yours and yours to own. And you get to share that with who you want to. Maybe I was doing it as at a larger scale than some people choose to share their stories, but she kind of gave me that. And I think that that is something that I held on to, is, and I would review that kind of every time when I would go to record, is this my truth? Is this my experience? Is this, you know, really what I can go to sleep at night saying, yeah, I went through this and I want to share this and give this to people as a thing to learn from. And so that's kind of the main thing. And then when it comes to, you know, some of that, I think it was just some of the comments, it would just kind of be along those lines that sometimes it's kind of not trauma informed. And I think her point of view is that she was proud that I didn't trauma dump. And she's like, I think in a sense, it's better to not go into explicit detail and harm survivors more. And so maybe if people wanted more, she's like, that's fine, but you're actually doing people a disservice by going into nitty gritty details, which, you know, that and possibly re-traumatizing them on a show. And if I were to go into that, and so she was like, I think that's a good way to actually go about it. I don't think she's ever listened to the show, which is totally fine. But I just, you know, I told her, I kind of explained to her what it was like. You know, I was like, I didn't go into the craziest details. I said as much as I felt like I needed to make an impact. And obviously that wasn't enough for people. And her kind of view on that was not re-traumatizing. And also just that it's exactly what I said. It's not a competition, and abuse is a spectrum. And that's kind of the conversation that we need to be having, is that it's not one single thing. And that's kind of been my main mission with this show, is that it's not one thing. And I think sometimes we can think that, or maybe if you've been through it a certain way, you think it needs to be that, but it looks like a lot of different things and can escalate into a lot of things. And so I think that's more so where I was coming from with this, but those are some of the conversations that we had.
Do you feel you have some sense of closure after sharing your story?
I thought it would feel different, I guess. I don't really know what I thought it would feel like. I got that response a lot of, oh my gosh, you're done. It's done. Congratulations. Exciting. You know, closing of a chapter. And I think I feel the weight of not having it all inside me anymore, which is great. On the other hand, I still feel like there's a lot that I couldn't talk about, didn't talk about, would have liked to talk about in a different way and just couldn't. And those are things that I need to continue to work on privately and through therapy and through healing. And so it's an ongoing thing. I feel good that it's not this humongous secret for me anymore, but you know, it's not just, oh, I finished in October and I'm great now. It's an ongoing thing.
What have you taken away from this experience, being able to share these stories, connecting with people, connecting with thousands of listeners, your audience, even riding your way onto the charts of Apple? So knowing that you're making a significant presence out in the world globally.
Great question. I am just grateful that it's been getting out there. It's honestly wild to see that and see it in different places, see the different messages from people around the world. I think that that is something that I didn't fully grasp, was kind of the global side of things. It's been doing interesting things in Europe and in Africa, and it's done really well in the US. We made it into the top 20 of relationships, which was awesome.
Congratulations on that. That is an
amazing
achievement.
Yeah, that's awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a fun thing, and you know, it's not a mission to hit everything in the charts, but it was just cool to see that happen. I think more than anything, going through this has just kind of continued to light me on fire for other people and for their awareness and raising awareness for that. And I think my story's out there. Take it or leave it. Interpret it how you want to. I hope and pray it lands with who it needs to and impacts who it's meant to and who I would love for it to land with. But more than anything, I just know that this has opened my eyes to such a larger audience of people. I mean, get messages every single day from people that I've known for a long time that I've never known, who have listened or said I stumbled upon this. I've been through something similar. And I think that that has been the most eye-opening thing for me. And you just can't comprehend. And you know, and I know the statistics and I know how many women these things impact and hit every day. But to really tangibly see that, I mean, on my cell phone, talking to people day in and day out, I think has been the most impactful thing for me and just really reinforce the fact that this needs to be talked about. I always say there's never enough people talking about it. How I talk about it is going to land with some people versus how you do it on your show versus how other people in this realm talk about it. And so I just feel like I'm going to keep going. I'm going to do it and kind of keep going with more episodes, and it won't be my story. Obviously, we've talked about me in far, far too much and in depth, but just trying to help spread that awareness and talk about it in any way possible because it needs to be talked about.
Thank you for joining Alan, Michelle, and I on Loveless Fridays. And now stay tuned for episode 1 of When Heaven Meets Hell. Thanks for listening, sharing, and supporting. Links to guest social media and some content mentioned are in our show notes. If you have a dating or relationship story to share or want to participate in a discussion here on Loveless Fridays, DM me on Instagram at lovelessfearpod or email me at lovelessfearpod@gmail.com. If you know someone who's being abused by a partner, there is help available. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. The National Domestic Violence Hotline provides essential tools and support to help survivors of domestic violence so they can live their lives free of abuse. Call 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233 or text START to 88788.
Please note, this podcast may be triggering to some as it discusses themes centered around emotional, physical, mental, and sexual violence. If you are a survivor or know someone suffering the effects of these issues, please take care while listening. Additionally, this podcast and content shared is for informational and entertainment purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for medical or mental health advice. This series and this work is dedicated to my nieces and the ones who call me Auntie Al. I know you most likely won't listen to this for a few decades, and my genuine hope and prayer is that you never experience anything like what we discuss here. But may you always know your worth, trust your intuition, stand firm in your truth, and know that you are loved beyond measure, just as you are in this moment. May you navigate this world with courage and grace, always believing in yourselves and the power of your voices. This is for you, with all my love. Welcome to When Heaven Meets Hell. I'm your host, Alan Amarongan, and this is the retelling of my experience with narcissistic abuse and coercive control from my perspective. In this podcast, I unravel my storybook romance turned nightmare when an unexpected breakup revealed my fiancé's double life, including a massive web of lies, deceit, cheating, and betrayal. Together with the help of world-renowned guest experts, we'll tackle the harsh realities of complex PTSD, trauma, and grief, illuminating these often overlooked issues and inspiring change for women facing these challenges. Episode 1. This is something that I have sat down multiple times to record, to re-record, to work on, and I can say that every time I do it, it never gets easier preparing to share what I am going to share in this series. I think all survivors can agree on the fact that you never think that this is going to be you. You never think that this is going to be your life, your decisions, your partner, until it happens. And you also never think that it's going to look a certain way. We have this misconception in our society that, you know, it looks like we see in movies or on SVU or whatever, but it doesn't in real life. And that is what makes these relationships so dangerous. And so this is heavy on my heart to talk about. And I know that it's going to help a lot of people. I try to move through life. I think I'm pretty even, head and heart. I think in this relationship, I moved in my heart a lot, and that carried me through it and carried me through the tougher times. And even afterwards and healing, I think even when my heart, it felt like I did not have one, or it was in a million little pieces, you know, leading with that and empathy for myself or the situation, I think that that carried me through. In the aftermath, this has been very heavy on it. What I mean by this is this conversation of intimate partner violence and narcissistic abuse and wanting to raise awareness for breaking cycles of abuse and challenging stigmas and advocating for awareness and support. And so I'm moving forward and moving through it with my heart. My head is saying, we don't talk about these things, but I know that this is going to open up conversations and hopefully help others. When Heaven Meets Hell really is, for me, it's really this suspended state of being disoriented and not knowing which way is up and down and who's good and who's bad and what's right and what's wrong. The roller coaster and the vortex that you get sucked into in these relationships is so intense and so isolating. And then the aftermath of not knowing what is going on and who you even are when you're facing the betrayal of coming out of these experiences. This is really about that blinding, dangerous, fiery deceit that happens and the ripple effect that comes from these events and what that looks like. So this is When Heaven Meets Hell. It was created with the goal of helping other women to not slip into the predatory traps of partnerships with narcissism or personality disorders, oftentimes resulting in the spectrum of physical, mental, and emotional abuse. The statistics remain that 1 in 3 women have or will experience some form of intimate partner violence in their lifetime. Yet 60 to 90% of these will never go reported to law enforcement, meaning the cycle continues. This is a statistic that I want to hold space for. This has been a big driving force for me. I can sit here and say that I know what the 1 in 3 looks like in my life. I can look at my friend group and say, 1, 2, 3, I'm the one in this case who has experienced this. And for other women in my life, more specifically for future generations, I am not okay with that number. That number is far too high. Also, the 60 to 90% that never go reported. There's a lot that goes into that, and we will talk about why these things are not discussed, why there's shame, why there's guilt, why there's a lack of awareness even around how tightly the line is walked and the confusion that is caused in these relationships. But that is really a driving force behind this show. And so my goal is to prevent women from having to carry a case number like I did, or carry a police officer's card in their wallet, or trade calls with their local prosecutor. I want to talk about these things and break the cycle of betrayal and deceit that have become all too common in the digital age. My story represents all the other women who are not able to come forward, who cannot come forward, who feel like they are silenced, who feel confused in their experience, who feel stuck, isolated, lonely. And this is a voice for them, an outlet for them, a resource for them. This is not revenge. This was about him for far too long. My life was focused around him for far too long. But this, to me, is a rewriting of the narrative that we are so commonly told about relationships and abuse. when you go through these things, what you experience is real and raw and true and honest. And it does get better, but it is so hard. And I see you and I acknowledge you and I feel you in that experience. So this is When Heaven Meets Hell. This is an experience that I never in my wildest dreams thought would happen, but I'm using it to help others. I want to get into sharing a little bit in this episode to give you guys some backstory on who I was before this. For those of you who might not know me, also, even if you do feel like you know me, there's probably some things you don't know, I feel like, that I have not shared. Get ready for that. Going really quickly, I guess, into that, and I just think that it's important. And so it makes it all make sense a little bit more too. So prior to all this, we'll go back a little ways. We'll take a little journey. Growing up was wonderful. What I want to focus on is that around age 10 or 11, I started having what I called was back pain. And that really manifested into a tornado of health issues over the years. So childhood was normal with my mom, my dad, my brother. Growing up felt stable. It was a typical, what I would call typical childhood. And then I just started not feeling good. I started experiencing pain, started going to the doctor for that. They said it was initially scoliosis and that I would grow out of it, but it just kind of kept going from there. And so this Cliff Notes version, I guess I'll say, is that I went undiagnosed for 10 years, misdiagnosed for 4 with an autoimmune issue. And then I ended up at the Mayo Clinic where I was told that I had fibromyalgia, central sensitization syndrome, and chronic fatigue syndrome. So essentially, my journey was a complete freaking mess. And in and of itself, it was extremely isolating, confusing, debilitating. This is the quickest and nicest way, I think, to go about it. But in every way, shape, and form, it created who I was as a person and as a young adult. Going through this at a young age, I felt very different than other people my age, I believe. And in my childhood after this did not look the same. So I competed in equestrian sports. That was my thing. But aside from that, I wasn't going to soccer practice. I wasn't doing those things. I was in the pool at PT, or I was at doctor's appointments, or I was having scans done, or I was going to the valley for doctor's appointments or whatever. And so my life looked very different internally, but externally you couldn't necessarily see it. I didn't necessarily show it or talk about it a ton. I just had a different experience. It wasn't the normal high school or college experience. So this meant that I did not date a ton aside from some high school boyfriends. And I bring this up because this is what the show is in reference to, but didn't date a ton in high school, a few high school boyfriends, but did not date at all in college. College, I was super sick and going through a lot health-wise. So coming out of college, I was on some pretty heavy IV treatments for being sick. It was just a very tough time. I was trying to start my career and do a lot of things. I just wasn't feeling better. In 2021, I went against medical advice, which is obviously not recommended, but I felt like that was my truth and I wasn't feeling better. I was super young. I was like, this is not my life to be on these medications for the rest of my life while not feeling any real relief. And so I went against their recommendations. I went off of everything. I pursued higher help, I guess. At that point, I had been up and down the West Coast at any kind of place I could really find or get into. And so ended up at the Mayo Clinic and just wanted a complete and total workup. And That is when they told me that I had been misdiagnosed. So the treatment that I had been receiving for the past 4 years was incorrect. They gave me what they felt like was correct diagnosis of fibromyalgia, central sensitization syndrome. So that is a nervous system disorder. Fibromyalgia falls into it, but it's where your nervous system misfires and amplifies sensory input, which results in pain, fatigue, brain fog, and sleep problems, which is super, super fun. If you do not know fibromyalgia, it is a disorder characterized by widespread musculoskeletal pain. I can never quite say that one. Also accompanied by fatigue, sleep, memory, and mood issues. Symptoms can begin after an event such as physical trauma, surgery, infection, or significant psychological stress. So there's a lot to unpack there. And I say those both for specific reasons. Essentially, though, my pain was everywhere. I would describe it as being deep in my bones. It was this, and still is, I'm still experiencing it. It's getting more managed, I think, but it's something that you can't get away from. A massage helps to relax me, but it never gets rid of the pain. I do want to be touched. I don't want to be touched. It's just like, you cannot get rid of it. It's in your core and it becomes you. And it, obviously, I don't know how anyone could go through that and not feel shaped by that. And so I was grateful for that shift in things and that diagnosis. I felt like I've wrestled with it for many reasons, and I could do a whole other episode on this. I actually have in past show that I did with my friend Allie. Love that for us. I can link that in the show notes. I did a full episode just on my health journey, but I ended up going back to Mayo Clinic and spent a lot of time there. I spent a month in particular for pain rehabilitation. I did a whole program on fibromyalgia one time. Pain rehabilitation, though, was a month long. We went off of medication. You spend every day there working on learning about these issues, going off of things, working on your physical health and kind of how to tailor a program to you, and learning about sleep and the eating and all this stuff. And it really is a well-rounded program. It's phenomenal, but it's a beast and it's a lot to uproot your life and for me to go across the country and do that. But we did that and it was helpful. And I came home and I felt a bit better, and I was working the program, and I started kind of trying to live a normal 20-something life. I was on the dating apps a bit here, and I was working on my business. I had started chronic illness coaching a few years prior, and I was working on that, and I felt good. I always, though, I think felt like there was something missing, like there was another puzzle piece. And this was a year later in 2023. So I'd been working the program for a year off of most medications, which was great and a big win after spending your life being thrown everything. I felt like a pharmacy and I would just take it all. You know, we were careful and cautious about things, but at the same time, I took a lot. And so being off of things was very helpful for me. I still felt like there was something missing. And I always look at this like a puzzle. And to me, there was a missing puzzle piece. There always has been. And so 2023, my therapist, I'd been with someone who was focused on people with chronic pain or chronic health issues, you could say. I'd been with her for 10 years off and on. Essentially, when they didn't know what to do with me at 18, they said, we think you should go see her. And so I went, and I had been seeing her off and on for 10 years. And she was wonderful. She was going to retire. And she said, do you want a referral to someone or do you want to be done? You've done a ton of work. You can be done. And I said, I really am curious about EMDR. If you don't know, that's eye movement desensitization reprocessing. It is a psychotherapy technique designed to relieve the stress associated with disturbing or traumatic memories. I felt like there was something else, and I wanted to kind of dig into the trauma of things. I knew that I had been through a lot, but she and I hadn't really addressed all of that. And so I started doing EMDR. August of 2022, I started. I didn't do a session until January 2nd of 2023. And that is when I recalled a memory. And I always knew, like I said, that there was something there. And I couldn't fully access it. I couldn't fully figure it out. And I went to my therapist with this specific event in mind. And like I said, I started in August. We spent months and months and months just preparing and making sure that I even felt good enough to handle whatever was going to come my way, or like I could process what was going to come my way. And so, like I said, that we spent months just working on that. January 2nd is when we did our first session. So basically the lateral eye movements, if you've done it, you're either holding little buzzers in your hands and you're calling out colors, or you're looking at a light bar. The lateral eye movements, while you are focusing, so you're physically holding these things and verbally calling out cues while mentally recalling this memory. And so the lateral eye movements reduce the emotional charge of a memory, so it can be discussed, digested, and essentially the goal is to strip it of its power to trigger anxiety and avoidance. So the memory never goes away, but your reaction, I guess, or feelings towards it lower or lessen is the goal. I know it's never going to go away. Therapy is not a magic wand. EMDR is not a magic wand, but it's really about lessening the heightened sensitivity towards that experience. And so we did a session on January 2nd, and happy new year to me. I recalled a repressed memory of being molested when I was 7. This happened in a doctor's appointment, a medical appointment. This is an experience that I always remembered. It stands out to me a ton, and for various reasons, never did I really associate it with anything bad. I remember the day very specifically, but yeah, I guess I always had questions around it, and I came to her with this very specific memory, and right when we dropped into it, I remember it, and it connected so many dots. It made so many things make sense. And really it got locked down at age 7. Obviously I didn't have the emotional ability to process it, so my body shut it down, and I disassociated and I fragmented it, and my body stored it. And in my belief with this, and it's hard because you can't prove it, but there is very strong evidence. There's a lot of studies out there that prove a link between early childhood trauma and development of chronic illnesses. So for me, this is my truth. I feel like it has connected the dots on chronic illness. We see that childhood trauma can trigger emotional and physical reactions that increase the risk of developing autoimmune diseases, cardiovascular diseases, and other chronic illnesses. So essentially, this would have happened at age 7. I would have locked it down, didn't have the capacity to talk about it, to explain it, to process it, to understand. There were also a lot of factors in that appointment that made it very confusing. That was a very specific appointment, and what was going on in that appointment was very unique. And so I think that also muddied the waters as well. And so I would have locked it down. Fast forward a few years to 10, 11, my body can't handle it anymore. And the stress produces these health issues. And then it just snowballs from there. And it doesn't come out until I am 28 and ready and able to process it, I suppose. So that was the start of 2023. 2023 was a beast of a year. That was January. I was going through it. They say that when you're going through these things, you don't know time. And so you're processing it like it just happened. So even though this occurred to me physically when I was 7, I was going through it as though it just happened. And so it was a very dark time for me, the start of 2023. You're going through day to day like it's normal. You're still showing up for things. You're supposed to be living life. Also, how do you explain this to people? It's very odd, but you feel like this just occurred to you, and it's so violating, and it's just awful is the only thing I can say. And so it was very hard. I spent so much time in therapy. I basically lived there. I processed through the anger, the grief on my own at home too. And I was feeling better, I believe. And I wanted a little bit of a change. I've always loved Montana. I wanted to go out there. And so in the spring, I was like, I'm finally going. I have done my time with chronic illness stuff. I've spent so much time in the doctor's offices. I want to go out there. I could work remote. And so I went out there and was going to be house sitting for a month and just enjoying and taking time and exploring. So I went out there in May of 2023. I felt like I had just kind of felt like I was feeling better and more grounded. And it was kind of a little reward to me to be able to be out there and enjoy and just have time. So what you will come to find throughout this series is that it looks a little bit different than a typical series in that this is not going to be solely standalone, either solo episodes or guest episodes. And that just speaks to the nature of telling this experience. And also, I don't want to leave a lot of value left on the table in not bringing other people on and not providing resources where I think there should be resources for other people going through this and people who can speak to these issues in other ways. And I believe that everyone will connect to this in some way, shape, or form, whether it's something that I say or something that a guest says or a combination. I think that, you know, we do better in community and in collaboration. And so as much as this is my story and I'm the one who needs to be the one to speak about it, I wanted to also be able to bring on other people as much as possible. And so you will be hearing from me. You will also be hearing from people who experience this with me as much as possible. And what I mean by that, I don't mean to repeat myself, but there are some people who I wish could be present and also who wanted to be present in this series, but didn't necessarily feel fully comfortable doing that for safety or security reasons. So we're going to try our best to do this justice for them. And then you're also going to be hearing from some amazing world-renowned guest experts on these topics that we are facing later in the series. So I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves, but just give you guys a little idea of what's going on here. And so for the sake of this episode and moving forward, you will hear from her again, but I want to go ahead and introduce my mom for a little bit. She has obviously been with me from the very start. She is someone who heard everything about this experience, I want to say probably while it was all happening in real time. I think there were some things that, as I'll talk about in the show, I probably held off a little bit longer in telling her, similar to some of my friends, but she, you know, knew everything. And she also has a very unique perspective because she is one of the few people who met him and actually saw us together as a couple. And so I couldn't not do the show without her. Obviously, she's been my major supporter and I would be nothing without her. If you know her, you know what I'm talking about. So I'm going to go ahead and bring on my mom. How would you describe me prior to this happening?
Well, confident. You have done so much in your 20s to grow and learn about yourself and your health and your personality and how to optimize things and manage. So I feel like you're positive, you're both introspective and very happy and confident and enjoy other people, enjoy meeting new people. I felt like you had your antenna up pretty good. You know, that doesn't mean anybody can get fooled and it's nobody, you know, you did nothing wrong, but I feel like you had trusting, but cautious.
Yeah. I don't think I fall easily. I think I fell pretty hard this time, but I still feel like I verify or attempt to. I feel like that is like part of my background of just going through health issues and stuff, always checking things out more.
Yeah. And part of your growing is opening yourself up to trust other people. So it's not a bad thing, but hopeful, confident, happy is how I would describe you.
What would you say now? I'm skipping ahead, but I'm curious now.
You've come a long way. What I would say a few months ago and what I would say now are probably two different things. I think you are learning how to gain trust again and not let one really bad experience define your life, because it's your life and you get to define it, not how somebody else's actions have defined you. That said, you had to work through it, and we always work through stuff that are our biggest challenges in life. So you probably, the old trust but verify, I think will always be there with you, that you want to trust people, but it's okay to ask questions and make yourself feel comfortable that they are who they say they are and that sort of thing. But I feel like you're just kind of coming out of it and just really proud of the work that you're doing to get back your feet back on the ground to define your life the way you want it, not to let somebody else define your life.
Newsflash. What you hear on this podcast is just the beginning. There's a whole world of powerful conversations waiting to be explored. Conversations that are redefining how we talk about narcissistic abuse, intimate partner violence, and mental health. Whether you're on a journey to reclaim your power and heal from trauma, seeking to educate yourself on issues dubbed the public health crisis of our time, or simply looking to engage in meaningful discussions, this is the place for you. Don't miss out on exclusive content, behind-the-scenes insights, and powerful resources. Join my email list to get the latest updates on episodes, expert tips, and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. No spam. Sign up today and become part of a community dedicated to healing, empowerment, and living authentically. Together, we can break the cycles and create a lasting change, but it takes a community. Find the sign up link in the show notes or in my Instagram bio at alan.amarongan. If you run into any issues, message me directly and I'll personally make sure you're all set. I was on the dating apps. And the dating apps people are being honest about the apps. The apps are rough, everyone. I had been on the apps, obviously, at home and gone on dates. I'm not a serial dater. I think I'm notorious for being very picky. I go through it very fast. My friends say, you know, you say no. But I am like, feel like I know what I'm looking for. I feel like also I just kind of, you would get a read after a while, and in a lot of profiles you couldn't see the person. I'm like, no, this is a no. There were a lot of things that I had, I guess, little standards for with that, but I felt like in general the dating apps were hard. You couldn't see the person. They had a really bad profile. You would send a message, they wouldn't reply, or you would hear from them weeks later. or there would be such generic conversations. Like, I don't care what your favorite color is, or I don't even know. They're so bad. My mind would block it out, obviously. Or they would have no intentions of meeting, or they would be in town for the weekend, which I would meet up with some people just like to meet people, I guess. But there were just really wild stories. Again, on my past show, Love That For Us, there were some wild stories on there. So go and listen to that if you want to be entertained, I guess. But it was a wild ride in general, but it was just rocky, and it was kind of like you never knew what you were going to get. I also felt like conversations became hypersexualized, or they would push you towards Snapchat, or all these things that were just like immediate no's for me. So again, I would go through people pretty fast or know what I was looking for. And so that was kind of my experience until then. So I had been in Montana. I was working, dating, not like crazy, but I had gone on some dates, and I was actually in the process of leaving. I had to come back home for a wedding, and I came across the profile, and I swiped no because it didn't meet my little standards. You couldn't see much. The bio didn't have much. And then the next day he came up again, and he had some new pictures, a few more things on there, and I swiped yes. The swipe that would change my life and ignite all of this. I swiped yes. I don't know how he came back up. I don't know the algorithms. I don't know any of that, but I understand more about how he operates and what he does with profiles, I suppose, but I still don't understand necessarily how that happened. But I swiped yes, and I matched him, and it was a lightning bolt. I was leaving town, and I just started a conversation. I knew I wouldn't see him, but I messaged him, and it was on Bumble, and so I had to message first, and I said something generic like, hey, how's your day going? And he messaged back and said, hey, dream woman. And it was a major ick, if I've ever met one. I felt like I was trying to be more accepting. Obviously, you know, I know that I go, not that I go through people fast, I don't actually, you know, go through them, but I feel like on dating apps, I would just say no a lot. And so I knew I'd go through people fast, and I was trying to be more accepting. And so it was an ick, but I let it slide. And it was a micro moment of abandonment. And I will talk about this a lot, where how different my life would be if I didn't let that slide. And there were a lot of these, and I can't knock myself for that. But for anyone going through this, I would say your intuition knows. My intuition knew, and I pushed past it because of what I felt I was supposed to do, and not because of what I felt was right. And what I felt was right was that was gross. But I replied, and just I kind of made a joke of it, which is in my nature. And I said, oh, you know, big shoes to fill. And in a way, we went from there, and he was charming, and he was captivating, and he was charismatic, and he was respectful, and everything that I had ran into previously on the apps, I didn't get from him. And he would respond, and I know this sounds like the bar is so low, but I don't mean that he would just respond, but he would respond, and he would take an interest. And I think what also drew me to him is that he didn't make comments about me or my body or my looks, or he didn't ask for photos or videos or all these things that I wouldn't do and wasn't interested in, but it was very just, I felt like it was high road a lot of times. And so I obviously appreciated that. And I felt like it was about getting to know me, and it wasn't anything about a hookup or anything like that, which obviously wasn't going to happen. We weren't in similar places, but that also wasn't my intention or interest. And so I felt like it was more intentional, and he also felt direct, and it wasn't flaky or, you know, wishy-washy or whatever. And so I was hooked, I guess. And so we had our first FaceTime. It was a late Friday night, and he was in his truck, and I will never forget that he kind of bent, he had, you know, the overhead console light on, and he kind of looked down and looked in the camera really hard, and he goes, "Oh, well, you're cute." And it was kind of like a that'll do vibe. And I never do well with compliments or anything like, and I just said, "Thank you. Can we move on?" kind of thing. And we had our conversation. And again, that felt innocent and not like it wasn't anything. It was just, you know, and so I said, "Thank you." And, but it was kind of, it was just said in a tone that was odd. And it was look, you know, and it was looked at, and I, you know, again, it was on FaceTime and whatever, but it was just done in a way that was odd. And so, again, a micro moment of abandonment. But we talked, we had our FaceTime. Right after we hung up, he texted me and he said he loved me. And enter, you know, stage left, some love bombing. Love bombing is when you are showered with instant love and affection, often told you are their soulmate. To a T. Dictionary definition. This is when the narcissist abuse cycle started. I did not recognize it. I'm aware of these things. To me, it was so outrageous that I didn't take it seriously, because you know that someone does not love you in that amount of time. Obviously. Like, I'm like, he knows that this is a joke. I know this, like, that's haha funny. And so, again, micro moment of abandonment. I said, "What are you going to do when you actually love me or fall in love with me?" And all I can say is that abusers will put you in a position of sacrificing the relationship or betraying yourself. And it was so crazy, but I went with it. And I didn't, it, you know, had he said it a week in, maybe, or 2 weeks in, I would have been like, "Oh, that's fast to say I love you," and maybe had more of like a red flag moment. But he said it then, and it was so outrageous that I was like, I know this is not true. This is a joke. Funny, you know, that's a weird way of flirting, but funny kind of thing. And so that's that. But really, he started me quick. All I can say is that I didn't see it. And I'm having a hard time, I guess, trying not to divulge too much or share all that I know now, because in the moment I didn't see it. Hindsight 2020, you can look back and say, "Oh my gosh." But all I know is that he felt fun. He was a lightning bolt of energy and affection and kindness, and he felt safe and new and exciting, and he didn't feel all the things that I feel now, obviously. Within the next week, we were on the phone talking. I mean, we continued to talk every day, but within the next week, we were on the phone talking, and he said, "What are you doing on the 4th of July?" And I said, "I don't have any plans." And he said, "Well, would you come out here and we could spend it together?" And I loved that. I love an adventure. I love that it was direct and that he actually had an intention of meeting up. I was excited to go back out there. I thought that the whole thing sounded great. It was someone who actually wanted to spend time together. And I said yes. And so I called him a day or two later when I was looking at flights and I was about to book one. And I said, hey, I just want to make sure that there aren't any red flags. And I don't think I worded it like that, but I said, you know, and we had talked about some of my crazy past relationships or people that I had dated, more specifically, I guess, and just weird stuff that had come up. And so I said, I'm just wondering, do you have any wives or weird hobbies or anything I should know about? And he said, there's no wives or weird hobbies. I have a past from a bad decision, but there's no kids, there's no fights or domestic stuff. And obviously I wish his record was clean. I can't fault him or judge him for something that was in his past. It's not obviously something extreme that would deter me significantly. And so I said, okay. And I felt that he was honest when I asked him, and he was always honest when I asked him questions. I felt like he would answer them directly. And I appreciated that. And I appreciated that he told me. And it seemed good. It seemed safe. It seemed fun. It seemed exciting. And so I booked a flight to see him. I booked a flight out there, and in a way we went. And from there, things took off drastically. I was in the vortex and didn't even realize it. You can say the train had left the station, the roller coaster was going, but I booked a flight out to see him, and it would only continue to take off from there. I'm going to go ahead and leave it there for this week. Next week, there is so much to dive into with us meeting and really getting into kind of where the abuse started. And we will dive into all of that. You get to actually meet him, I guess. Lucky you. And we will go from there. So I will see you next week on When Heaven Meets Hell. Thank you for tuning in to When Heaven Meets Hell, produced by me, Alan Morongan, and co-produced, edited, and scored by Brad Parsons at Train Sound Studio. Although less than 1% of podcasts address domestic violence and survivor advocacy, When Heaven Meets Hell strives to change that narrative by raising awareness and promoting vulnerable conversations. You can support our mission by making sure you subscribe on your preferred platform, leaving a review, and sharing the show with others. We are so deeply grateful, and we'll see you next time on When Heaven Meets Hell.